U.S.-China relations are at a low point, but Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is in Beijing this week and will be focused on one thing that has not changed that much.
We have a lot of impact on each other's economies.
Betting that economics will deliver where politics can't. And in Afghanistan, women's spaces just got even smaller. The Taliban are closing down beauty salons.
This is, I think, really the first attack by the Taliban on women's ability to work in the private sector.
I'm Marco Werman. Plus, in one of the biggest sporting events of the year, the Tour de France, this American cyclist in the prestigious polka-dotted jersey is winning over the French.
A lot of people have been writing my name on the road and holding up cardboard signs with my name on it, and it's just really inspiring.
Those stories and much more on today's edition of The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for coming along today. The U.S.-China relationship is often described as a failed marriage with the family still living together. No doubt the relationship is rocky, but deep financial ties continue to bind the U.S. and China together. So a lot was on the line today as U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen touched down in Beijing. Yellen is in the Chinese capital for 4 days of what will likely be difficult talks about trade, investment, and tariffs. Here to help us understand what's at stake with this visit is Susan Thornton. She's a senior fellow at Yale Law School and former acting assistant secretary for East Asia Pacific Affairs. Susan, expectations for Secretary Yellen's visit to Beijing are not sky high, but where realistically do you think the two countries can make progress?
Yeah, I think it's really important, first of all, that Janet Yellen just goes to Beijing. We haven't had a Treasury Secretary there for a long time. And, you know, macroeconomic coordination between the world's two largest economies is crucial. I think she's going to probably be focusing on that macroeconomic coordination, also sort of the macro picture in the world in terms of, you know, there are a lot of debt-distressed countries, but also just the U.S.-China macro picture, and we have a lot of impact on each other's economies.
Yeah, so kind of mezzanine-level stuff. I mean, U.S.-China relations are at a real low point, with each side suspicious of the other. How can Secretary Yellen go about finding ways for both the U.S. and China to work together? Like, what will she need to focus on, and what will she need to stay away from, at least in this opener?
You know, she's got a number of new counterparts there in China that she's going to have to, first of all, establish contact and personal relationships with. I think the Chinese are going to want to hear from her on a lot of the more bilateral economic issues, tariffs, trade, export controls, the so-called concept of de-risking, which the U.S. has been touting.
Briefly, what does de-risking mean? What does that entail?
I think that's one of the big questions the Chinese are going to be asking Janet Yellen, because nobody's really sure at this point. It seems to be a way of more narrowly targeting what was previously discussed as the concept of decoupling, which seemed to sort of encompass a very potentially broad scope of cutting off from each other's economies. We didn't, when we embarked on this experiment of globalization, envision a day when we would have to try to undo that. And I think it is proving to be more difficult, perhaps, than people expected.
There's one big issue at the moment, and that's key minerals that both the U.S. and China need for advanced technologies like microchips and solar cells, gallium and germanium specifically, which China has said it's going to restrict exports of. Can progress be made, do you think, on access to those materials?
Well, I think the Chinese are going to be trying to show that they also have some cards to play. They do have a lot of these minerals, mainly because other countries haven't developed them due to environmental concerns. So there's two possibilities. We could work out some kind of a deal, or other countries will start to produce them in spite of the environmental concerns.
Susan, you have been in the room for high-stakes U.S.-China negotiations. Where are the points of leverage now, and who has the most leverage?
Well, I do think the Chinese, in light of the increasing troubles that they've run into in their post-COVID economic recovery, I think they're quite worried about where their economy is going. I think there are a lot of policies out there on the global side, too, on the part of other countries that are worried about where the economy is going. And so I think this fragility in the global economy and the perceptions of governments that they need to do a better job on their economic management could give the U.S. some leverage here. I do think that it's probably not realistic to think that the Chinese side is going to back down on some of these things it considers to be core to its economic development. So hopefully that won't be the tenor of the conversation. Hopefully it would be more of a negotiation and seeing where there are areas that would be profitable to both sides to try to sort of curb some of these measures and get growth going again in a global sense.
Susan Thornton is the former acting assistant secretary for East Asia Pacific Affairs. She's now a senior fellow at Yale Law School. Susan, thank you very much for being with us and for your insight.
Good to be with you.
Moldova is a small, impoverished country that sits between Ukraine and Romania. In recent months, it's seen a string of anti-government protests. The demonstrations were organized by an opposition party in Moldova called SHORE. It's led by Ilan SHORE, a wealthy pro-Moscow Moldovan who actually resides, it's believed, in Israel. Last month, a Moldovan court ruled that his SHORE political party was unconstitutional and should be banned. But its leader says he's not giving up, as we hear from the World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry.
Ilan SHORE was once one of Moldova's most famous businessmen. He inherited a chain of duty-free shops from his father and bought a football club, a fleet of flashy cars and a few TV stations. He's also married to this woman. That's Jasmine, a well-known Russian pop star. In 2014, SHORE became chairman of a Moldovan bank, Banca di Economy. A year later, his bank was caught up in what's become known in Moldova as the theft of the century. Almost $1.5 billion were siphoned out of three banks in a huge money laundering scheme. SHORE told the BBC at the time that his bank had had its troubles long before he was appointed.
When we took over the bank, we were horrified. There was a 7 billion lei hole.
SHORE denied any involvement in the heist and a short time later announced he was entering politics.
I think it was a clear pathway for him to escape charges and to escape the trial.
This is Moldovan political analyst Christian Vlas. SHORE took over a political party founded by a Russian journalist and renamed it the SHORE Party. In 2017, he was sentenced to 7.5 years in prison for money laundering and fraud. But SHORE appealed the sentence and continued with his political campaigning. 2 years later, his party won 7 seats in parliament. That same year, the Moldovan authorities issued a national warrant for his arrest, and this time he fled the country. SHORE headed to Israel, where it's widely believed he's lived ever since. And for the last few years, he's led his party from afar. Christian Vlas says that party's outlook has a lot in common with the Kremlin.
It is a party which undermines the pro-European integration path of Moldova, who tries to undermine any anti-corruption efforts. And that's one of the aims of the Kremlin as well.
Over the last year, the SHORE party organised regular anti-government protests on the streets of the capital, Chisinau. Demonstrators said they were angry with the high cost of living, but local journalists uncovered evidence that the SHORE party was paying people to go to the protests.
They would usually bring in 2,000 to 5,000 people, mostly elderly, coming by bus, leaving by bus, getting hot meals.
That's Andrei Curararu with a think tank called Watchdog Moldova. Last October, the US imposed sanctions on Ilan SHORE. The Treasury Department said SHORE had received Russian support and was actively trying to create political unrest in Moldova. Then a couple of weeks ago, a top court in Moldova ruled that what the SHORE party did was unconstitutional and ordered it to be dissolved. Ilan SHORE took to Facebook to vent. Today, Moldova is run by bandits and thieves, he said. Moldovan politicians are puppets of the West. A few days ago, SHORE announced he was forming a new political bloc. Andrei Curararu says SHORE's popularity rating right now is low, just around 4%, but he says it would be wrong to write him off.
He also commands a bit of charisma, a bit of anti-hero who doesn't follow the rules but takes care of his own.
Curararu says some Moldovans still see SHORE as a kind of a Robin Hood figure. In April, a Moldovan court increased Ilan SHORE's prison sentence for bank fraud to 15 years. But there's little sign of him returning to Moldova to serve his time. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The Prime Minister of Cambodia, Hun Sen, is the longest-serving leader in Asia. His Facebook account has more than 14 million followers. On Telegram this week, he wrote that he's quitting Facebook. That announcement followed a recommendation from Meta, the parent company of Facebook, that Hun Sen's account be suspended. Meta's oversight board accused Cambodia's leader of threatening political opponents on the platform and said he should be banned for 6 months. This is all playing out as Hun Sen, after 38 years in power, is actually preparing to resign as prime minister after an election later this month. As the world's Patrick Wynn reports, this strongman leader is going to be a tough act to follow.
A musical ode to Cambodia, composed by the prime minister himself. Yep, Hun Sen writes songs, often with grandiose lyrics. But this is a man who goes by the official title, Illustrious Prince, Great Supreme Protector, and Famed Warrior. Hun Sen holds himself in very high regard. If I wasn't running this country, he said in a recent speech, war would break out for sure. Over the years, he said this a lot. As a young man, Hun Sen saw war, even getting his eye shot out. He was a commander with the Khmer Rouge, a vicious communist regime. Then he turned on the Khmer Rouge and helped establish the modern Cambodian state. Nearly four decades later, he will retire. But didn't he say that without him, the country will collapse?
He did. He had said these things, but also he had said that he's going to remain in power until he's 90 years old.
U Wirak is the founder of Future Forum, an independent Cambodian think tank in Phnom Penh. He says that Hun Sen, despite his pronouncements, was really just waiting until his sons were ready to take over. The oldest son is 45-year-old Hun Manet, an army general. He'll likely take the prime minister's seat through an election in late July. And he'll almost certainly win, because all viable opposition candidates have been banned from running or exiled. U Wirak says, expect the son to rule like the father.
I think he will become more like his father, but with ability to communicate better to the West. And that could be his sweet spot.
Though Hun Sen grew up poor, his son, Hun Manet, has been groomed for power. He speaks English, he went to West Point, the U.S. military academy, and he even owns a house on Long Island. Cambodia is not a rich country. Its economy is similar in size to that of Jackson, Mississippi. But that never stopped Hun Sen from wearing million-dollar watches, despite an official salary of about 2,000 bucks a month. Despite the family's wealth, Hun Sen still tries to give off a folksy vibe, giving long, rambling speeches in rural villages.
It's like your grumpy uncle who keep on saying things on his mind, global issues or minute issues like who should win boxing.
He'll go on about boxing and then talk about his favorite singer on Cambodian Idol. But he doesn't like taking questions from reporters. The West is critical of Hun Sen's corruption and his persecution of dissidents. But he calls the United States, which bombed Cambodia heavily in the 1970s, the real human rights abuser. Since the 90s, the U.S. has treated Cambodia as a country broken by war that can be rebuilt into a liberal Western-style democracy.
Cambodia has been a Western project. Many people within the West believe that Cambodia is still a Western project, maybe a losing one, a failed project, but it's still a project.
Problem is, Wirak says, the U.S. currently has no real strategy for Cambodia, other than trying to pull the country away from China, its main trading partner. He says Washington is still stuck in a Cold War mentality. The rise of Hun Manet, who's young and U.S.-educated, is a chance for the U.S. to reset relations, if the White House is ready. In any case, after this election in July, it's unlikely that the political career of his father, Hun Sen, will suddenly come to an end.
The assumption is there will still be Hun Sen after he so-called retire, and I think he'll still want to play a very important role behind the scene anyway.
It's not clear what sort of official title 70-year-old Hun Sen will retain after this summer. But he is expected to remain the leader of his Cambodian People's Party, probably still giving his long speeches. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. These are uncertain economic times for a lot of us around the globe, but the biggest companies on Earth made over $1 trillion last year in windfall profits. That's what Oxfam and the social justice group ActionAid learned by analyzing data from Forbes magazine. Profits at energy companies were so high last year that they led to the creation of a whole new batch of energy billionaires. To help us understand how this happened when so many people have been struggling economically, we reached out to William Lozonik, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts. Professor Lozonik, first of all, there is an economic definition of windfall profits. What are they exactly?
Well, my definition, or the definition as I understand it as an economist, is a little bit different than the one that's in The Guardian and in the report. For me, windfall profits are profits that come to a company, even though it didn't do anything to get those profits. And certainly in the oil industry or in energy, where world prices are set, even ExxonMobil, as powerful as it is, does not set those prices. That's windfall profits. But most of the rest, I would call just either profits because they've been innovative, which isn't necessarily most of them, but profits because they're price gouging. Now, price gouging for me is not windfall profits, because it means corporate executives have assessed how much they can screw their customers, basically, and jack up the price. I mean, an obvious example is the pharmaceutical industry, where it's well known that Americans pay at least twice as much as anywhere else in the world for the same drugs, and often even more than that. And that's because the drug companies can get away with it, and they jack up the prices, and they make more profits.
So regardless of the definition of how these companies and what they actually made, windfall profits, price gouging, is this kind of growth problematic in your view as an economist?
Yeah. So for me, it's problematic not just because they're making more profits and often consumers and other businesses are paying higher prices and maybe that's driving inflation. The bigger problem for me is how companies use their profits, because they're not using their profits to pay their workers more. They're not using the profits necessary to invest in more innovation. They're using them to jack up their stock prices. This is nothing new. This has been going on since the 1980s, and it's gotten worse and worse and worse. And that's really what's driving huge inequality in the system. It's not just the profits, but it's the extraction of those profits to corporate executives, hedge fund managers, Wall Street, basically.
I mean, don't you see some possible benefits for shareholders? I mean, there are a lot of people who hold shares through retirement funds, right?
Yeah. So in Europe, where also this price gouging and profit inflation is going on, it's much more dividends. And it varies by country how that's distributed. Of course, it's shareholders if you happen to have enough money to invest in the stock market or have money in the stock market.
Or if you have a retirement account.
Yeah, and your retirement account directly or indirectly. But all shareholders do not gain from the buybacks. Warren Buffett bought $36 billion of shares on the market. Not 1 cent went to Apple. He has a gain of about $120 billion on that. That's how the rich are getting richer. And we can see it in the aggregate numbers, the extreme income inequality. And this is really at the heart of it.
Bottom line, Professor, what is your reaction to this news from Oxfam and ActionAid?
Well, I think it's good they're doing the work, but I think that this particular report doesn't go far enough, because it really should be talking about what they're doing with the extra profits, not just that they're getting extra profits.
William Lozonik is professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts, helping us understand a new report from Oxfam and ActionAid that detailed record profits for the world's largest companies. Professor, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
The Dalai Lama turns 88 today. He is the 14th Dalai Lama, and his tenure has been the longest of all. Like all mortals, as he gets older, there is the prospect of his inevitable passing. But what happens with the next Dalai Lama, that's a cause for concern, especially for his supporters. Sushmita Pathak reports from the Tibetan Buddhist leader's home in the Indian Himalayas.
The ringing of a spinning Buddhist prayer wheel pierces the silence on a quiet afternoon in Dharamshala. This small town in northern India is where the 14th Dalai Lama has lived since fleeing Chinese occupation in Tibet in 1959.
India offered the God King of Buddhism a safe refuge from the communist Chinese.
Tens of thousands of Tibetans followed their leader to India, including Tenzin Legden's grandparents. The 25-year-old free Tibet activist grew up in a refugee settlement where everyone was devoted to the Dalai Lama.
Every morning, my grandpa and grandma would, the instant they wake up, they would pray to him. And before retiring to bed in the night, they would pray to him.
In exile, the Dalai Lama introduced Tibetans to democracy, setting up the Central Tibetan Administration, essentially a government in exile. In 2011, he gave up all his political powers. Amitabh Mathur, former advisor of Tibetan affairs to the Indian government, says he did so to bolster Tibetan unity.
The whole idea of his withdrawing from a political role was that the process of democracy should throw up leaders who would have the loyalty of Tibetans across sectarian lines from all four major schools of Tibetan Buddhism.
Today, the Dalai Lama remains Tibet's foremost spiritual leader. He doesn't travel much because of his age, but regularly meets supporters at his home, including some from China and Taiwan.
The Dalai Lama continues to be the embodiment of the Tibetan struggle, and all Tibetan hopes and expectations are centered around him.
A few months ago, Tibetans gathered in Dharamshala to pray for the leader's long life. The special ceremony was organized by the Central Tibetan Administration. Tenzin Lekshe is the spokesperson.
When we pray, there's only one prayer. May his holiness live thousands and thousands of years. But that's not possible, in fact.
Lekshe says time is running out to resolve the Tibet-China conflict. Dialogue with China, deadlocked since 2010, must resume in the presence of the current Dalai Lama, he says. The leader may be reincarnated, as is the norm, but China says it will appoint a successor. The Tibetan government rejects that idea.
His Holiness is the only person to decide upon. Nobody else. The matter will only be at the disposal of His Holiness.
A tussle is likely to break out over the next Dalai Lama. In 1995, soon after the Dalai Lama identified a six-year-old boy as the reincarnation of another high-ranking monk, Chinese forces took the boy into custody and installed someone else, who is rejected by Dalai Lama's followers. Something like that could happen again.
The Chinese expectation is, once this extraordinary human being, the Dalai Lama, is not there, the Tibetan unity that he has achieved in exile will splinter, and then they will, you know, be able to succeed in altering the narrative in Tibet.
Tenzin Legdin, the activist, says the Dalai Lama has been preparing Tibetans to continue the struggle without him.
I think we should be right now ready to, you know, like move forward to take the cause in our own hands now. Now, the biggest fear that we have is how would the Tibetans inside Tibet would receive passing away of His Holiness. I strongly believe that the Tibetans inside will not pay allegiance to that Dalai Lama, whoever like the China installs. But China will find ways to maneuver around that, to somehow control the Tibetans.
Tenzin Lekshe, the government spokesperson, admits it will be a difficult time.
Obviously, there'll be a chaotic situations. Obviously, it'll be a very sad situations. But when the sun sets, it's obvious that the sun will rise.
The institution of the Dalai Lama has been through 13 transitions. It will survive another one too, he says. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Dharamshala, India.
You're listening to The World. A hip-hop artist in Iran spoke truth to power, calling for human rights for all and calling out government repression. Now he's behind bars, facing the possibility of death.
Essentially, this is all related to his music and social media posts.
That story as we continue our summer series Planet Hip-Hop and more, still ahead this half hour on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The Taliban have ordered all women's beauty salons in Afghanistan to close their doors. Owners were given 1 month to shutter their businesses. It is just the latest in a series of moves by the Taliban targeting Afghan women and their freedoms. They're already banned from higher education and from working for international NGOs. Women are also not allowed in many public places like parks and gyms. The World's Shirin Jafari has more.
When the Taliban took over Afghanistan by force almost 2 years ago, one of the images that circulated online was that of women's faces being blacked out on billboards and public signs.
These photographs are used for advertising on the outside of beauty salons in Afghanistan, and suddenly they'd been painted over. And so it was a very kind of powerful visual symbol of how things had changed.
Heather Barr of Human Rights Watch says suppression of women has been central to the Taliban's mission in Afghanistan. For two decades, the group indoctrinated its fighters by telling them that women's rights is a Western concept and a plot to undermine Islam.
And so the suppression of women, I think, became part of what their fighters felt that they were fighting for.
The result of that indoctrination is evident in Afghanistan today. Over the past 2 years, the Taliban have systematically taken away women's freedoms. Barr says the recent ban on beauty salons is particularly concerning.
This is, I think, really the first attack by the Taliban on women's ability to work in the private sector.
After banning women from working in the government and most NGOs, the private sector was the only area left for women to earn a living. Malihe has owned a beauty salon in Farah province in southwestern Afghanistan for the past 22 years. She says yesterday, as she took down the sign outside her salon, tears rolled down her face. We have no hope in this country, she tells me. Women have no place here. Malihe, who only gave me her first name because she fears backlash from the Taliban, is the sole breadwinner of her family. Her husband had a stroke recently and is unable to work. They have 4 kids. Our family of 6 is now relying on God for sustenance, she says. Further north, in the province of Herat, another salon owner, 32-year-old Niloufar, tells me the news has left her speechless. She and her 2 sisters opened up their business in Herat city 10 years ago. She too didn't want me to use her full name out of fear of the Taliban. She says the salon offers a range of services: haircuts, nails, eyebrow tattoos, bridal makeup. The 3 sisters employ 8 women. Now they have been forced to shut down. She says after the Taliban banned women from getting an education, we focused our attention on this salon. It was our only hope. Roughly 60,000 women will lose their jobs as a result of this ban, a source from Afghanistan's Ministry of Commerce told the BBC. That's at a time when there has already been a 25% drop in women's employment since the Taliban took over the country, according to the International Labour Organization. The ban on beauty salons will undoubtedly increase poverty among women, says women's rights activist Razia Barakzai. Barakzai herself was among the first women to take to the streets to protest the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in 2021. She says she was arrested, taken away, and beaten. She says even under the barrel of the Taliban's guns and after being lashed, we shouted at them, "You don't have any legitimacy." Barakzai had to flee Afghanistan and lives in Pakistan with her family. But even there, she says, she doesn't feel safe. She rarely leaves the house. Barakzai says she won't stop speaking out against the Taliban's assault on women's rights. She has been in touch with salon owners in Afghanistan. They've told her that the group is going after their male relatives too, warning them to make sure that the salons are shut down. Heather Barr of Human Rights Watch thinks the new ban will have long-term consequences for women in Afghanistan, because she says beauty salons there are much more than a place to get a haircut or a manicure.
These salons are one of the very, very few spaces, maybe one of the only spaces that's left in Afghanistan where a woman might be able to go out from her home and see other women and share information and share support.
Now even that has been taken away. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The steam engine, that great symbol of the Industrial Revolution, underpinning those years of production and growth, was metal, and more specifically, iron, a material that earned its muscle thanks to gains made in British metalwork. But a new study says that a lot of innovation with ironwork took place somewhere else, in Jamaica. Jenny Bulstrode is a historian of science at University College London. Her new study shows Jamaican ironworkers were instrumental in the development of the technology that fueled the Industrial Revolution. And Jenny, the specific innovation you trace back to Jamaica is called the court process. What is that exactly?
It's called the court process after the name of the guy who patented it. We might need to talk to Jamaicans about whether we need a different name for this process now, yeah. Because part of the point of this story is that court stole this process. You take scrap iron, bundle it together, heat it in a specially designed furnace, and then feed it through grooved rollers. What you take is a very poor quality iron that's brittle, and you create wrought iron on an industrial scale. Iron that you can use for steam engines, you can use for steamships, you can use for great iron buildings, iron structures.
So this process, the court process, patented by this British financier, Henry Cort. But as you say, he stole it from Jamaicans. Who were these people in Jamaica that you traced all this back to?
This was a foundry in Jamaica that was owned by a white enslaver, but it was actually operated by 76 black metallurgists, the majority of whom were enslaved. Not all. Some were Maroons, fugitives from enslavement. They're freedom fighters who won their autonomy.
What's interesting is that some of those names tie back to West Africa, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Devonshire, Mingo, Mingo's son, Friday, Captain Jack, Matt, George, Jemmy, Jackson, Will, Bob, Guy, Kofi, and Kwasi. Now, Kofi and Kwasi are associated with Akan heritage in particular and identify those two individuals as either coming from African descent from Ghana, from Akan heritage. The majority of the enslaved metal workers would have been born in Africa.
How did you figure out, though, that this particular group of 76 enslaved people was behind the style of metalwork?
I came across an archaeological report of a foundry in Jamaica. This was showing the court process taking place very successfully, making a lot of money in Jamaica before Cort's patent. And that's when I started to dig a little bit further, archives, newspapers, baptism records, and this whole story begins to kind of uncover.
And then how does Cort learn about these innovations and bring them back to England?
Henry Cort heard about this from his cousin, who was a ship's master shipping between Jamaica and England. Basically, within months of hearing about this, he lays out a lot of money. And the next thing you see is that Jamaica is put under military law. The foundry is razed to the ground. It's packed up onto Admiralty ships and shipped back to Portsmouth, where Henry Cort operates.
The Industrial Revolution narrative, it's so powerful, especially in the UK. And here's this man, Henry Cort, who is credited unfairly, as your research shows, for this key part of the Industrial Revolution. I mean, what do you want people to take away from your findings about who our historical innovators really were?
I think this is so important. There's a narrative around innovation that tells us to picture someone like Elon Musk. You know, that same narrative that erases the people whose skill and ingenuity, working hands-on together as teams, drive real innovation. It's a narrative that denies black people the recognition of their achievements, and it's got to change. I've worked with a Jamaican colleague, Dr. Sheree Warmington. She's an expert in development and reparations. And if you speak to her, she'll tell you that this isn't just about sugar, tobacco and cotton. It's about black intellect and innovation, which was robbed from the colonies and used to build the wealth of the global north of today. This is a very important moment, with reparations movements gaining more and more ground. It's time that the countless other innovations that were stolen from colonized countries are recognized.
Jenny Bulstrode is a historian of science at University College London. Jenny, thanks a lot. Great to speak with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
50 years ago, hip-hop was born in the Bronx, inspiring generations of artists around the globe to speak truth to power. In the Islamic Republic of Iran, doing that takes a lot of courage. Hip-hop shows are banned, mixtapes are sold in secret, and rappers have faced prison time just for doing their thing. Now a 32-year-old rapper named Tumaj Salehi could pay the ultimate price for his work. As part of our summer series, Planet Hip Hop, the world's Duri Bhaskaran reports.
In a country riddled with censorship, Tumaj Salehi stands out because he speaks his mind.
In this song called Rat Hole, he condemns people who are complacent about the abuses of the Iranian government. In these lyrics, he says, forced officer, executioner who only obeys the orders he receives, by a rat hole. The first time this Iranian DJ heard Tumash Salehi's work, he was impressed, he says. We're keeping him anonymous for his safety. Through a translator, he says that despite Salehi's working-class roots,
you could clearly tell how educated he is, and you could tell the high quality of the technicality and the music that he produced.
Tumash Salehi's work is brave, this DJ says, not just because of his words, but because he knew what the consequences would be, and he continued to release music from inside Iran.
America is an example that, yes, hip-hop is used there as a way to speak out to authority as well. But we can see that people can have their own microphone there and say whatever they want and criticize whoever they want in authority, and nothing can happen to them.
In Iran, you can go to prison for that. As a result, many artists, including this DJ, have moved to Turkey to pursue their work, especially after a major crackdown that started almost a year ago. Last September, Iranian morality police arrested 22-year-old Mahsa Amini for allegedly wearing a compulsory hijab incorrectly. She was severely beaten in prison and died, sparking nationwide protests that are still ongoing. Salehi documented the moment in this song called Battlefield. We turn a deaf ear to the dictator with the instrument of women's rights, life, freedom. We fight to the death, he raps. Iranians in Istanbul, including the DJ, formed a group to amplify voices from the protests and bring international attention to the cause.
So we would take shifts even just not to let the social media attention to slow down.
Tumash Salehi's posts, like this one, were a major part of the campaign. As Salehi released videos of himself participating in the protests, he'd send helpful information, like places where police were stationed. He even shared advice on how to keep your phone from being tracked by authorities.
In the most risky, in the most dangerous of situations, he has always accompanied people.
But Salehi knew he was being hunted by the government. For weeks, he moved from safe house to safe house. On October 30th, security forces descended on the place where he was hiding, arresting him and two friends. Days later, Iranian state media released a video of him, bloodied and blindfolded, saying he made a mistake.
He was not protected from torture and other ill treatment.
Nassim Papiani, a senior campaigner for Amnesty International, says Salehi's arrest goes against international laws. Salehi faces many charges, including corruption on earth, which carries the death penalty.
Essentially, this is all related to his music and social media posts, which were criticizing the authorities and calling for freedom and human rights basically for everyone in Iran.
At least 22,000 people have been detained in connection to the Mahsa Amini protests in the past year. Seven have been executed. According to Salehi's attorney, the rapper's verdict could be announced within the week.
He was living his art.
Holly Dagris is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. She says Salehi has long served as a voice for disillusioned youth in Iran. He described his mission in an Instagram video recorded before his arrest, but posted by friends afterwards. Dagris translates.
The upper classes have a voice enough. I think rap is the voice of suffocated throats.
A week before his arrest, Salehi released this song called Fall, a reference to fortunes told through the patterns that coffee grinds make when you turn your cup upside down. In the music video, he's dressed all in white, standing in a desert as the sun sets.
And in the video, which was filmed again in Iran, you see him sitting across from an Iranian official. Like, you don't see the face of the official. It's someone dressed as one. And he's rapping and he's reading the coffee grinds to tell the Islamic Republic's future and that it's not going to survive.
How many young people do you kill to build a tower for yourself? He raps. At the end, Salehi leans down to whisper in the official's ear, 44 years of your government is the year of failure. On that day, you will attack each other. Take this omen to the leader. For the world, I'm Dari Buscarin.
If you are watching, count yourself among the 3.5 billion people around the globe tuning in for France's most epic sporting event, the Tour de France. It got underway this past Saturday. This is not, as you know, a one-and-done kind of bicycle race. It's 21 grueling days of pedaling through villages and sunflower-lined roads up into the steep Pyrenees Mountains and the high-altitude Alps. Each rider's daily finishing time is added to their total time from all the previous days of racing. The rider with the fastest total time gets to wear the yellow jersey, the Maillot Jaune, the next day. But there are other jerseys of prestige in this race, like the Maillot à Pois Rouge. That'd be the white one with red polka dots. It goes to the king of the mountains, the best climber on two wheels. American Nielsen Paulus, who rides for Team EF Education First, Easy Post, grabbed the polka dots on day one and has been battling to get it back after the race's first day in the Pyrenees Mountains. We caught up with him on the phone after yesterday's race. So, Nielsen, what does a cyclist do to earn the King of the Mountain jersey?
It's a bit of a tricky battle throughout the whole Tour de France because we pass so many climbs throughout the Pyrenees, the Alps, and all the little hills in between. But every climb in the Tour de France is classified as either Cat 4, Cat 3, Cat 2, Cat 1, and Hors category. Today, we just climbed over the first Hors category climb.
That means outside of the category, right? So it's beyond 1, 2, or 3.
Yes, yeah. Basically, I have just been trying to rack up as many points as I could, crossing as many of those summit lines as I could in first to get the maximum amount of points. And I was rewarded with the polka dot jersey for the first four or five stages of the race. I only lost it today, but it's a long tour, so I'm hoping to come back in the next couple weeks.
Yeah, so today was the first day in the Pyrenees Mountains, and Felix Gall of Austria took the King of the Mountains jersey from you on a mountain summit that, well, what were the conditions today? What made today's climb so out of the ordinary?
Well, there was a really big battle for the yellow jersey today. So every rider in this race was attacking with everything they had. So it was just a fight from start to finish, and it was just chaos, and it was a pretty incredible day of bike racing.
Well, you sound confident about maybe getting the polka dot jersey back, but how did it feel giving it up, and what are you going to have to do to get it back?
Yeah, losing it today was a pretty big blow. I was hoping to get into the breakaway today to score points.
The breakaway that you're talking about is a small group of riders who accelerate away from the main pack and just try to stay ahead all the way to the finish line, right?
Right. Unfortunately, I was in a few breakaways early on, but those were all chased down by other riders who thought they had a good chance at the polka dot jersey themselves.
Something you just said, Nielsen, also struck me. What is it like to be an American wearing that famous polka dotted jersey in this very French sporting event?
I think I've gained a lot of French fans, honestly. It's really, they love people who just, you know, wear their heart on their sleeve and just go for it.
How has that been playing out?
It's been really nice. I mean, I feel like there's been a lot of well-received attention that I've been putting out into the countryside in France. And a lot of people have been writing my name on the road and holding up cardboard signs with my name on it. And it's just really inspiring. You know, I grew up watching the Tour de France on TV, and I always thought the polka dot jersey was one of the coolest jerseys out there because it was just this funky jersey that you have to be so brave to go after.
And it flashes too, that thing.
Yeah, it was a bit of a childhood dream come true.
I watched a video of your team car pulling up to you on the race course and handing you a sack of food while you were riding. How do you eat while you race, and what do you eat?
We have three pockets on our back, and we stuff those pockets with gels, energy bars, and our water bottles. We're not carrying just water. We're carrying basically sugar water. Professional cyclists are a bit of an experiment for how much carbohydrate you can push through your stomach into your muscles.
Yeah, and I hate to get into it, but relieving yourself, we won't go deep into, but suffice it to say it happens while the wheels are rolling often, right?
Yeah, especially nowadays, everyone's trying to save every small percent they can. So if you stop for a nature break, you know, you have to do a lot of work to catch back up to the peloton. So most of the time, what I've been training myself to do better and better is on a descent, just stand up, pull your shorts down a little bit, and you know, you can go on the go.
Yeah, strategy in every domain. Cycling has gained this notorious reputation for performance-enhancing drugs. What is your sense about this year's tour? Have the anti-doping protocols gotten ahead of the problem?
That's interesting, because I actually just had control today, doping control. So essentially every day they have random tests, and every rider is obligated to fill in where they sleep every night and where they are for basically every hour of every day so that they can be tested at random. And I believe cycling now is probably the most strict Olympic sport in the world, because the way we've made ourselves available because of cycling's past, now it feels like we're at a point. I mean, I don't see how anybody could get away with anything, because I mean, I'm tested, like, I don't know, weekly almost in my home while I'm out at dinner.
So like you're having your steak frites and they're like, come to the bathroom, we need to get a urine sample.
Yeah.
Does that happen?
Yep. It has multiple times.
Wow.
It's annoying when it does happen, because if you're out at, you know, dinner with friends or something, you have to try to explain to them why you have to leave early or just, you know, abandon them for a while. But, you know, I've gotten to the point where I've begun to find some success in cycling. And as soon as I started to feel like I was starting to perform at the top in the sport, it just immediately gave me so much relief, because I mean, I'm able to do that clean, and I'm so happy that I don't have to worry about being pressured.
Nielsen, how do you define a successful tour for yourself?
If I can end up wearing the polka dot jersey on the podium in Paris, or win one or two stages, I would say that would be a successful tour for me.
Well, we're wishing you good luck. That's Nielsen Paulus, a professional cyclist for Team EF Education First Easy Post. He grabbed the King of the Mountains jersey, the polka-dotted one, on day one and held onto it until today's first stage in the Pyrenees Mountains. Nielsen, thank you for your time and good luck.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
A quick update. After we spoke with Nielsen Paulus yesterday, he was back on the hunt for that King of the Mountains jersey. And during another stage in the Pyrenees Mountains today, he made it into the breakaway, took more mountain points, and now he's back in the polka dot jersey. Faire du Nord, Paris-Roubaix, Tour de France, La Côte d'Azur et Saint-Tropez. We leave you today with electronic music pioneers Kraftwerk, a track of theirs from 2003 appropriately titled Tour de France. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for listening. Keep on pedaling.